Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is David Enrich, author of Dark Towers, Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump, and An Epic Tale of Destruction. It was published by Custom House, an imprint of HarperCollins, February of this year. David has worked for the Wall Street Journal. In 2017, he wrote The Spider Network. Also in 2017, he was hired by the New York Times. Dark Towers explores two of my very least favorite entities, Deutsche Bank and Donald Trump. The story starts with a personal tragedy, the suicide of William Brokesmith, perhaps the most honest, used locally, employee of Deutsche Bank. There are lots of suicides, one murder. Brokesmith's son, Val, figures prominently, especially as a source of information about the book. We hear about Edson Mitchell, a Western-type gunslinger trader. I mean, stock trader, you know, deals with derivatives and swaps. He took the bank from being a conservative, kind of like the bank in Mary Poppins, to one that cherished those swaps and obscure and labyrinthine derivatives. Also, Joseph Ackerman, who was a short-term profit maker guy, looking for 25% each year, driving the stock up and destroying the bank, and he did so. An example of the bank's stupidity and cupidity is Kristen Bitar, one of the traders who made a $100 million bonus. And of course, Russia and Putin. And then the main, maybe corollary, the main point of the book is Donald Trump, Ivanka, and Jared Kushner, and a dash of Justice Kennedy, Rick Rubin, Mushin, lots of other famous people. So, by the way, check out Deutsche's stock price. It's gone from 154 before the crash to 6 as of today. So with that, welcome, David. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, first question. Did you start playing the French horn because you wanted to be the wolf?
You know, Wikipedia drives me crazy. I didn't want to be the wolf, but I was inspired by Peter and the Wolf. And but, you know, my Wikipedia page, I had nothing to do with that. And it says that I'm a very accomplished French hornist. And I only wish that were true. I stopped playing the French horn when I was in probably, I think, 7th or 8th grade. So, and without going into exactly how old I am, that's a long time ago. So I'm afraid I'm not an accomplished French hornist, even though I do still love Peter and the Wolf.
I figured you probably played with Eugene Ormaney in the Philadelphia Orchestra.
It kind of, the Wikipedia page kind of makes it sound like that. And I don't know who puts this stuff on there. It's not me.
That was the one that was narrated by David Bowie, and I really liked it. So sorry, I'm trying to sell your book. So let's talk about, there's so many ways we could start this, but let's talk about Deutsche Bank briefly from its beginning through World War II and beyond.
Because sure. It's fascinating. So, yeah, it's a really interesting history. And Deutsche Bank was founded almost exactly 150 years ago in 1870. And it started out, this was the dawn of the industrial era in Germany and all over the world. And so it started out as a bank that was designed to help big German industrial companies spread their wings internationally. And there were the company Siemens, which was just getting its start at the time, was a prime example of that. And so for its first 50 years or so, or 60 years even, Deutsche Bank was a really kind of critical part of the German and European economy. It was, not only was it helping big companies expand and do things that were really important at the time, but it was also financing infrastructure projects all over the world. So it was one of the leading developers of railroads, not only in Europe, but also in North and South America and in Asia. And so it was really, I mean, I think Deutsche Bank during this period was a really constructive, healthy force for economic development in the world. And it was also deeply entwined with Germany's kind of national institutions. And so as the Nazis came to power in the 1930s, Deutsche Bank very quickly went from being this force for good to being a force for evil. And the bank helped finance the Holocaust. There's no point in kind of glossing over that. And they helped the Nazis, they helped pay for the construction of concentration camps. They helped pay for the construction of factories that made poison gas. They helped the Nazis sell gold internationally that they had extracted from the teeth of Jews. They helped take over Jewish-owned businesses all over Europe and helped kick the Jews out. So, and after the war ended, Deutsche Bank was found to have been a participant in war crimes. The bank's leader at the time was convicted of war crimes. And so it was really synonymous with the Nazi activities and genocide. But after the war, it got back to what it had been doing previously, which was really helping Germany and Europe engage in kind of normal economic activity. So Deutsche Bank became a leading force for the reconstruction and redevelopment of Europe after the war. It became a leading advocate for, I think you could say, global economic integration and development, including advocating for the forgiveness of third world debts and things like that. So it was kind of the textbook definition of a bank that was at least trying, in its view, to play a role for financial good in the world, with the brief and important exception of its stint financing genocide. And then in the late 1980s through the 1990s, Deutsche Bank's executives decided that they wanted to get a lot more profitable very quickly. And the way to do that at the time was to start developing a business on Wall Street in the city of London, doing investment banking and buying and selling and trading all sorts of really complicated financial instruments. And these were all businesses that had much higher profit margins than the traditional kind of bread and butter lending and financing activities Deutsche Bank had spent its previous, 12 decades specializing in. And so the bank became much more profitable, much faster, and in the process developed this culture of pushing the envelope and in many cases just completely disregarding ethics, morality, and often the law. And so that was really the period in which Deutsche Bank got big on Wall Street was the period where it really lost its moral compass and went from becoming this kind of iconic European financial institution to being one of the primary sponsors of destruction in the corporate world.
Well, so the reader who is, knows a little bit about economics, but you get into so many arcane things. So why don't we explain, one, swaps, which some people know, but yeah, then with regard to derivatives, which, say, Warren Buffett has derided for decades, talk about derivatives and then how complicated and absurd and irrelevant they can become with regard to their connections.
Well, first of all, I mean, I think one of the things I would say is that while these things are arcane and technical and complicated, I've tried to write this book in a way that will appeal and be coherent to people who have zero expertise or even interest in finance or economics. And I think that a lot of what happens on Wall Street over the past couple of decades is that as things have gotten more complicated and more technical, a lot of the people at the top of Wall Street have gone out of their way to make things seem much more complicated than they really are, because that allows them to kind of pull the wool over people's eyes and also allows them to justify the massive amounts of money they're making for themselves and their shareholders. And so I actually think a lot of this stuff sounds complicated on a kind of superficial level, and it is complicated, but it can really be boiled down to its essence in a way that's not all that complicated. And one of the examples I'd like to use for derivatives, which, kind of sounds scary and can be scary, but at their heart, they actually can be very effective. I mean, so if you're a company that makes ice cream, for example, you obviously, if dairy prices go up, that is going to make your business less profitable because you're going to have to spend a lot more money for milk and cream and things like that. And so you can buy derivatives that whose value goes basically moves in the same direction as dairy prices. So if dairy prices go up, the derivatives that you own will also gain value. And so you'll make money off the derivatives at the same time that you're losing money off of the higher dairy prices. And so derivatives in their simplest form are a very effective means for businesses, small and large, to manage their risks and reduce their vulnerability if prices or weather or interest rates or things like that change dramatically in the future. And so the advent of derivatives in the kind of the modern world, which it really took hold in the 70s and through the 80s, actually for a great many businesses and people, it was a really good development that allowed them and their businesses to operate much more efficiently with much less risk and therefore be able to lower prices for consumers. And so the ice cream cone you're buying from the ice cream truck is going to be a bit cheaper because the company that's manufacturing that ice cream isn't exposed to the possibility of milk prices going way up if there's a bad milk season. So when this got out of control, though, is that big Wall Street banks, and Deutsche Bank was among the leaders of this in the 90s, decided that derivatives were not really, it wasn't enough to just have these be an effective tool for customers to manage or, as the industry says, hedge their risks. The Wall Street firms wanted to make a lot more money. And the way to do that was that they could kind of reinvent these derivatives as a vehicle for speculative investing on their part. And so banks developed these big internal divisions that did very little other than making their own big market bets, often using derivatives. And you know, derivatives can, as Warren Buffett likes to say, they can be the equivalent of financial weapons of mass destruction because derivatives are not something that you can buy and sell on a stock exchange or on the bond market the way you can for normal investments. These are things that are negotiated generally in secret between two or more private parties. And so there's no central way to, first of all, to buy or sell these things, but also if one big bank or one big insurance company, for example, runs into financial trouble and they've done a lot of derivatives business, all of the other people that have done derivatives business with that bank or with that insurance company can then get in trouble themselves. And so it can become a mechanism for actually spreading risk throughout the financial system if these are handled imprudently. And that became one of the central causes of the 2008 financial crisis, is that everyone had been using these derivatives in a really reckless manner. No one was paying attention to where the risks were kind of buried. And every financial institution out there, or at least most of them, was doing this in a very greedy, kind of only looking out for themselves manner. Regulators were nowhere to be seen. And so as big financial institutions like Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns or AIG collapsed, they started taking down everyone along with them. But Deutsche Bank for a very long time, and still to this day actually, remains one of the world's leading purveyors of derivatives. And they made a decision pretty early on relative to their peers that these were not an exciting new invention because they would help clients. These were an exciting new invention because they represented a huge new opportunity for the bank and the bank's traders to gamble with them. And they did so very effectively for a while. And in the past several years, it's become clear that they were really basically the bank had been lying about its exposure to these things, and its losses on them have just been kind of lurking on its balance sheet unrecognized for many years. And as investors and customers and regulators have caught on to the scheme that Deutsche Bank was using, it's become quite clear that Deutsche Bank is more or less insolvent. And that's, I think, largely, you mentioned the stock price earlier. The fact that their stock has fallen by about 95% is a pretty telling indication of just how far the bank has fallen and just how little anyone trusts the bank and the bank's managers.
Well, because it's my friend Mike and I, for the past 5 years, we've been saying you can't make this stuff up. But we've been saying it so often that it's become meaningless, because even the way Trump is treating the coronavirus, you couldn't make this stuff up. It's impossible. So it's way, way beyond this. And I mean, I'm kind of a dumb investor. I've been buying high and selling low all my life. That's my method of investment. But what I don't understand is that's me, a dumb guy. these guys are all, you know, geniuses, MBAs, Wharton, et cetera, et cetera. And you go into it in great detail. And because it's such a thematic part of your book, how can they be so smart and lose sight of what they're doing and the enormous risk they're taking? And then coupled with the fact that you have these, which you can explain, the two boards that Deutsche Bank had, and these guys are old state guys. You talk about the dark oil paintings, which is great. So how did that, how does it, it didn't happen right away, but how does it continue to escalate without people saying, beside your hero, Brokesmith, how does it actually happen?
Well, I think it's just human nature to a certain extent. And that's one of the things I've tried to do in this book is really show from, you know, these big bad institutions that everyone hears about are not big and bad kind of intrinsically or by their nature. They're big and bad because they are led by human beings who do big and bad things for whatever reason. And the one of the things I've really tried to do with this book is understand the human decisions and the human incentives and the human choices that went into, that basically led Deutsche Bank, the institution, to become big and bad. And I mean, I think the one of the very simple things at work is that when people, including the senior executives at Deutsche Bank, when things went well for them, they got very cocky and they mistook what had been a series of pretty lucky outcomes for them. They mistook that luck as skill. And, you know, that's a mistake that we see every single day, whether it's in business or finance or government or really in any field, and in sports, certainly. And it's, to me, the catastrophe of Deutsche Bank is that people were mistaking luck for skill, got very greedy, got very cocky, and the normal checks and balances that would be in place both within Deutsche Bank, but also outside of Deutsche Bank and with regulators and even investors, they just completely, utterly failed in this case to instill any sense of discipline or ethics or just control on the place. And so the worst impulses of and the worst decisions made by people up and down the food chain at Deutsche Bank, where they were just kind of allowing their good fortune to go to their heads and think that they would always have good fortune, that went completely unchecked. And so it's really a series of just governance failures and kind of institutional failures that allowed these bad but understandable human decisions to snowball into something that ended up not only nearly taking down Deutsche Bank, but had a huge economic implications for a number of like major economies around the world. It led to all sorts of companies going bankrupt. It led to some people dying, and it also led to the election of Donald Trump as president. And these are all, these all come from the same place, which is that Deutsche Bank was greedy, and its executives were greedy, and its investors were greedy, and it pursued basically without stop the quickest, most profitable choice at every decision, instead of ever thinking for the long term, or instead of ever thinking about, well, this makes sense now, but how are we going to justify this 10 years later? How are we, what are the risks entailed with this aside from the very short-term financial risks? And so I think Deutsche Bank is going to become a very powerful case study eventually of how not to run a financial institution and the real peril, or really any big institution at all, financial or otherwise, and really the perils of not only short-term greed, but just viewing the evaluating success and failure through a very, very narrow lens, where the only thing that matters is the short-term profits and absolutely nothing else. And we, as we see with Deutsche Bank, that is just a recipe for not only the institution self-destructing, but also just destroying a lot of other stuff around the world in the process.
Well, it's interesting because the other side of the coin, and you mentioned it now about deaths, if you can be so ebullient and so happy and collecting a $100 million bonus, how can, when things fail, be so bad? And we can mention William Brokesmith, and you can use him because he seems to be kind of a hero in your book.
Yeah.
How can things get so bad that the only alternative is to end your life?
Yeah, it's a good question. And by the way, I apologize if you're hearing kids scampering around in the background. I'm working from home along with everyone else these days. Look, Bill Brooksman is, as you said, kind of the narrative, or one of the main narrative vehicles I've used to tell the story of Deutsche Bank's rise and fall. And he was the son of a minister in the Midwestern United States, and was his father instilled in him at a young age a real sense of ethics and right and wrong. And Bill is one of the, he got into banking, he was an expert, he was like a real math whiz and investing whiz, and was an expert in derivatives and risk management, and so very like technically oriented. But managed, he was one of the only people I've ever seen in the banking industry who's managed to both climb up the ranks through an institution in a very effective way, but also managed to maintain, to kind of stick to his principles and maintain his sense of ethics and morality. And so as he climbed within Deutsche Bank, he also managed to keep being the person who was willing to say no and willing to kind of voice the unpopular opinion and stand up to his superiors. And he became known informally within the bank as the conscience of the place and kind of the ethical compass for a lot of people. And as Deutsche Bank grew more powerful and bigger, he, Brooksman's role became more and more important because he was really the only person willing to kind of tap the brakes when everyone else was just stepping on the gas. And in January of 2014, Brokesmith was found hanging in his apartment in London. And I was working in London at the time as a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. And very shortly after Bill's suicide, I got in touch with his son, Val, who also happened to live in London at the time. And that allowed me to kind of have a front row seat as Val, who is a musician and had no finance expertise whatsoever, went on this crazy years-long journey to figure out, first of all, why his father killed himself, and then second of all, once he decided that it was in large part because of Deutsche Bank, to inflict some vengeance against the bank. And so it becomes this, and this ends up being a story not only about this big bad financial institution, but it's kind of a father and son story about a father who tries to do right, but really is just so overcome by despair that he gives up. And then his son's efforts to kind of make his father in death a kind of a warning and a symbol of the excesses of the finance industry.
I had a question about Val, and it's kind of, you know, not off the wall, but aside from the book itself, it's like, Val is portrayed as, he's definitely not a hero, and he has tremendous flaws, and yet you acknowledge him at the end in the acknowledgments and talk about what a wonderful source of information he was for you. Was he upset about the way you describe him or some of the things that he did in the book, or did he just accept those as, yeah, that's what I did?
Well, I think both, actually. I'm not sure I agree with you, by the way, that Val is not a hero. Like, he's flawed, and he has a lot of warts, you know, but so do we all, right? And he definitely has, he definitely made, like, some serious mistakes in his life. But, you know, it's hard when a lot of people have, right? And so I have actually a lot of sympathy and respect for Val, but did my best to portray him in as honest and kind of unsanitized a fashion as I could. And so I think Val kind of acknowledges everything wrong with what he did. I mean, he's someone who's had some substance abuse issues, and he's someone who had stolen his mom's credit card information and run up huge tabs on that and kind of hacked into people's emails. But at the same time, he certainly acknowledges doing those things. I think he was very frustrated with me at points in this years-long relationship that I was making more of that kind of stuff than he would have liked. But so it's been, you know, I've been a journalist for like, God, 20 years almost. And this is by far the most complicated, intense source relationship I've ever had. And there have been good moments and bad moments and a lot of very memorable moments. And look, in my read of this, or at least in my writing of this, I wouldn't want people to walk away with this thinking like Val is a bad guy. I would want them to walk away with it thinking Val is a complicated guy with lots of conflicting emotions and motives, and, you know, and at times is a bit of a mess. But at the end of the day, Val does something that I regard as being really in the public interest, which is that, you know, he got into his father's emails and found that his father was sitting on thousands and thousands of Deutsche Bank emails and documents and spreadsheets and things like that, and that reveal this extraordinary inside glimpse inside this financial institution that the world simply would not have seen were not for Val. And Val has done, I think, a real service to the world by disseminating a lot of that information to journalists, including myself, and also to law enforcement and regulators. And so, look, I don't always see eye to eye with Val, and I think people who read the book are going to come away thinking Val is, like, definitely not as pure as the driven snow. But I also think that portraying him with that kind of warts and all, in that warts and all way, makes him it's just more honest. It's more realistic. It's who he is. And I think if you you can kind of whitewash it, but it's just who he is. So, yeah.
Well, okay. Well, that's okay. That's a good analysis. Well, the other thing I need to tell my readers is that you copiously document, just like, say, Eric Larson would, in your notes at the end notes, all of these things very carefully. And I think that's important too. I didn't mean to suggest that you had changed or.
Oh, no, I didn't take it that way.
Okay. So here's.
No, and by the way, it's like totally fair game to. Like, Val has been angry at me and has been fairly public about that. And you can look at his Twitter feed and you'll see that for yourself. I try to put myself in the shoes of the people I'm writing about, just in general as a journalist, but I have never been the subject of kind of a proctological examination the way Val is. And it's not only in a book, it's also in the New York Times. And that's like, that's got to be really hard. He bared his soul with me over a period of many years, and that's hard, and it's painful, and especially because the subject here is tragic, right? His father killed himself, and he's estranged from his family now, and that's a hard thing to do. It takes a lot of guts to do it, and so I have a lot of respect, but it's been the sausage making in this book and in the newspaper articles that went into this are like, you know, it's not always pretty.
No. And the interesting thing, too, is, you know, I own this independent bookstore, and what I don't understand, and the difference between Trump and some of these characters, I mean, characters, not characters, who do kill themselves, or maybe in one case, a murder, they reach a horrible end. Yet I have, you know, sitting at the front of my bookstore on the front table, your book. I have A Very Stable Genius. I had Fire and Fury. I had Fear by Bob Woodward. I had The Room Where It Happens, A Higher Loyalty. There's tons of them. But none of them have affected in the slightest Trump. And they all were designed to explain the man. And you do as well. Why is it that none of this, and hopefully yours will, but none of this seems to affect the manner in which he's perceived by the public?
Well, I think that, I mean, first of all, my goal in writing this book was not to affect the way the public saw Trump. I mean, my goal was to explain part of the reason that Trump got where he was, but also to tell the story about how this financial institution that just very few people in America had even heard of became this global force of destruction, of which Donald Trump is one very important manifestation, right? I mean, it's not, they're the same reasons Deutsche Bank was supporting Donald Trump are the same reasons that it was, you know, laundering money and violating sanctions and evading taxes, manipulating markets and on and on. But look, this is a very polarized country we live in right now. And I think there are people on both ends of the political spectrum who have their minds pretty firmly made up and are not going to be budging one way or the other. And frankly, are probably not reading stuff that would even challenge their perspective. I mean, and that certainly is true on the right, but it's also probably true on the left as well to a certain extent. One of my goals of this book, in addition to just explaining how Trump got to where he is that, you know, I've been a business journalist my entire career, basically. And I kind of viewed the fact that Trump was involved in this as a way to get people who are obsessed about Trump positively or negatively to read a book that is about Trump, but it's also not about Trump, right? And I've been really pleased to hear from a lot of people who've read the book, who read picked it up thinking that this is going to be like provide all sorts of ammunition to take down Trump, read it, and some there is, I guess, some ammunition to take down Trump in there, but a lot of people ended up reading and being like, yeah, this is like, I now understand a lot more about the way the business world and the financial world operates. And to me, that is really empowering information if you get to understand that a little bit better, because you can realize that a lot of these kind of topics that seem so obscure, so complicated, and so kind of elevated really aren't. And you can understand these big, powerful financial institutions the same way you can understand a big political institution or a big governmental institution or a big academic institution. It's not that much different. It's the same human decision-making and human incentives that go into the place. And so I don't know. I mean, this is, you know, people are going to think what they want of Trump. And I can't think of any writing one way or the other that has either pro or anti-Trump that has changed anyone's opinion. And that's for better or worse, right?
Yeah. I mean, yes, I understand. And when I watched your interview with Anderson Cooper, I realized the people who are watching Anderson Cooper be incredulous are the people that don't like Trump. And no Fox, you know, watcher is going to be watching Anderson Cooper do this. I understand that completely. But at the same time, in that interview, which is, you know, relatively short because it's on CNN, he was just as I am. He was incredulous. Question after question, and I watched it very carefully. He was incredulous that the bank would do what they did for so many different reasons. You know, one of which was his celebrity, one of which was, you know, one branch loaning him money and the other branch allowing him to borrow the money to pay back the other branch. I mean, so all right, well, so go in, why was he and why am I so incredulous, honing in on the Trump transactions, that this could have occurred? Because it is.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
It's totally crazy.
And it's, I mean, there are basically no limits on the bank's recklessness and just greed in its dealings with Trump or with Russian oligarchs or with like the Syrian regime or all over the world. This is a bank that was putting short-term profits above literally everything else. And the irony is that with Trump actually played Deutsche Bank, in my opinion. And this is a guy who is, even before he started doing business with Deutsche Bank in the late 1990s, was someone who had over and over again defaulted on his debts and his company's debts and declared bankruptcy. And that made him off limits to the mainstream banking world. And yet Deutsche Bank was so eager to establish a foothold in the United States and make a name for itself, that it threw caution to the wind and started lending him hundreds of millions of dollars. And then even after he defaulted on debts with Deutsche Bank, not once but twice, a different division of Deutsche Bank each time would kind of tiptoe back into bed with him and restart the relationship and throw yet more money at him. So, I mean, it's a really clear illustration of how not to run a bank. And yet Trump, for all his sins, turned out, and maybe this is accidental, but for all his sins, turned out to be pretty savvy at getting exactly what he wanted out of Deutsche Bank, which was simply more money. And so the bank ultimately put him in a position where he could present this image to the world as a successful businessman who, right up through the presidential election in 2016, was still developing properties and building stuff, and could say accurately when people like Hillary Clinton criticized him for all of his defaults and all of his bankruptcies, Trump could honestly say that if I'm such a deadbeat, then why on earth is one of the world's biggest banks happily doing business with me to this day? And he was right. I mean, so Deutsche Bank really did help him protect and then polish his image as a respectable, successful businessman, even though, you know, by any measure, he was at best someone with a very checkered business background. At best.
Yeah, I like when you, and this is perfect, it's like when you say Hillary Clinton's and you use the word flat joke, that all his books seem to end at chapter 11. You know, that just didn't work, and it just doesn't work. And unfortunately, she was the candidate that seriously couldn't win. But be that as it may, talk about the story about because we are talking about how amazing it is, about when the financial crisis hit, that he sued Deutsche Bank for loaning him the money based on a force majeure type of argument. And actually, well, he defended the lawsuit, and then he actually sued them for loaning him the money. That was a good story.
Yeah, I mean, there's Trump's cleverness in wriggling out of his obligations to people is pretty legendary. And he pulled off one of the great escapes in financial history, I would say, in 2008, when he had borrowed a few years earlier more than $600 million to build a big skyscraper in Chicago. And 2008, the financial crisis comes and the money is coming due. And Trump's plan all along had been to repay the loan using the proceeds of having sold a lot of condos in the building. And yet, with the financial crisis in full force, no one was buying the condos. And so he came up, and his lawyers came up with a fairly novel legal strategy, which was that in the contract, with this kind of standard language that says, like an unavoidable natural disaster or something, it essentially can void parts of the contract. And it turned out that just days earlier, Alan Greenspan, the former Federal Reserve Chairman, had described the financial crisis at the time as a credit tsunami. And what is a tsunami if not a natural disaster, they thought. And so they filed a lawsuit against Deutsche Bank seeking to invalidate his debts because the tsunami had hit. And also, in this great act of financial chutzpah, sought, I think, $3 billion in damages from Deutsche Bank for having itself caused the financial crisis and having engaged in predatory lending practices against him by trying to collect the money he owed. And the ridiculous thing is that once again, Deutsche Bank, having now been sued by his client, tries to wash its hands of him. And then a few years later, another division of the bank gets back in bed with Trump and in fact lends him the money so that he can repay what he still owes this different arm of Deutsche Bank. So it's just kind of a tale of utter dysfunction within this bank that allowed Trump time after time after time to bounce back from what for mere mortals would have been probably career-ending failures.
And United States, which put the Deutsche Bank in an incredible dilemma. And the one that I always think about is because, you know, he's impeached on this one phone call. But the hotel in Washington, and this is much more of a political question, it's filled all the time, and people are paying an enormous amount of money, including Pence, to stay there. So why is he not impeached based on the emoluments clause? Why didn't the Democrats begin right there? I mean, it's fairly, without using any profanity, fairly obvious what he's doing. Why is that not the way they proceeded?
I have no idea. You would have to ask the Democrats that. I mean, there's certainly that something that's gotten a tremendous amount of attention. It does seem like, you know, these are weird times we live in. That's obviously something that we've never seen before. It certainly is not the kind of activity that would be normal for a president. And it remains remarkable to me, but I have no idea what the Democrats' thinking was or was not in terms of trying to impeach him for violating the emoluments clause.
So we talk about weird times. Why don't we talk about some of the peripheral characters that I didn't expect to hear about, Justice Kennedy or Rick Rubin or Mnuchin, or there's a number of them that you wouldn't have expected to enter.
I mean, so to me, the most interesting one of those is Justin Kennedy, who is the son of Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. And Justin joined Deutsche Bank in the late 1990s, just as the bank was making this big push onto Wall Street. And Kennedy was one of a number of people who was primarily responsible for the Trump relationship for basically a decade. And he was one of the people who he made hundreds of millions of dollars in loans to Trump, and over time developed a very close personal relationship with not only Trump, but also his family, including Ivanka and also Jared Kushner. And by the time Trump was sworn in as president, the Trump administration, the White House, really saw an opportunity to take advantage of the close bond that the president and his family had forged with Kennedy, because they were very eager to get Kennedy's father, Anthony Kennedy, to step down from the Supreme Court so that that Trump could essentially fill that vacancy. And so the White House went on this real charm offensive to win over Justice Kennedy, in part by appealing over and over again to him about citing the great relationship that Trump and his family had with Justice Kennedy's son. And by all accounts, that proved to be effective. And I'm not sure that that's the one thing that led Justice Kennedy to retire when he did, but it certainly didn't hurt. And as we all now know, that led to an opening that was eventually filled by Brett Kavanaugh. And in a lot of ways, that was Donald Trump's, one of his biggest victories in his first term of office. And I think, a lot of evidence that shows that Deutsche Bank, indirectly through the past relationships it had forged, played a role in coaxing Kennedy off the court and giving Trump this huge victory.
Hey, so I couldn't end this without this then, since you talked about that. And then we'll end this because I know you got time constraints. But talk about, this is, you can't make it up. Talk about when Trump steps off the podium after hilarious.
So it's Trump's first address to a joint session of Congress. This is in, I guess, February of 2017, if I've got my dates right. And, he finishes his speech, and as is the custom, walks through with the audience and is shaking hands with people in the front row, and it's the Supreme Court justices. And he walks down the line of justices until he gets to Anthony Kennedy, and he stops. And the cameras pick him up. They're exchanging some pleasantries, it looks like, and no one really knows what is said. But Justin Kennedy is sitting at home watching this unfold on TV, and calls his father afterwards and says, "Dad, what did the president say to you?" And Anthony Kennedy responds, and I'm not going to get this quite right because I don't have the book in front of me, but essentially says, "Justin, he was asking about you. He says hi to you." And it turned out that Trump, this was kind of the launch of their charm offensive with Kennedy. And he had said, how much I love your boy and how much my kids love your boy and what great care they're taking of him up in New York. And it was, and then he made a remark, the next person over was John Roberts, the chief justice. And Kennedy kind of pats him, Trump kind of pats Kennedy on the shoulder and tells Roberts what a great guy he has. And so it's Trump using the relationship that he had built with Justin Kennedy at Deutsche Bank as ammunition, I guess, or as a carrot maybe, to really build comfort with Justice Kennedy and develop a rapport with him that would make the justice more comfortable about the prospect of retiring.
Okay, well, I mean, there's so much more in the book. And like I said, even though the bookstore is closed right now, it is sitting on the front table. And we do have an online, Libro.com, where you can buy books online as well, or you can buy them wherever you buy books online. But it's a great book. And I wish we could delve deeper into it, but it could take hours. But thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to talk to us about Dark Towers, Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump, and an epic trail of destruction.
Thanks for having me.
We were speaking with David Enrich, Dark Towers, Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump, and an epic trail of destruction. I could have gone on for hours with him because the book is so deep, well-researched, and comprehensive, not only about Deutsche Bank and its history and what it did during World War II with the Nazis, which is horrible, developing Auschwitz and Cyclone B, really bad. Kind of erased, but still there. And it really delves into what, my friend and I have been saying this stuff, you couldn't make it up, for the past 5 years. And now it's even beyond that. It's just like a parallel bizarro world. Be that as it may, thanks for joining us during these strange times, and keep joining us because it gives you something to do. And if you have insomnia, you can listen to me talk for an hour or so. So upcoming guests include Victoria James. Her memoir is, you know, much lighter. It's called Wine Girl, The Obstacles, Humiliations, and Triumphs of America's Youngest Sommelier. And she's really nice, and she really brings the level of talking about wine to a point where we can all understand it. And then the renowned ornithologist and nature illustrator, David Allen Sibley, who's going to join us to discuss his new book, What's It Like to Be a Bird? From Flying to Nesting, Eating to Singing, What Birds Are Doing and Why. We'll see how that comes out with me. So join us every week and next week for another edition of The Avid Reader.